This person is lacking in the depth of character and in the sense of responsibility which we all must have in order to survive. So relationships become forms of discipline. If we accept them graciously, we grow. If we do not accept them graciously, we interfere with the development of law and order in our own consciousness as well as in the establishments we maintain. I think, therefore, we have to realize for once and for all in this world that we are not here primarily simply to enjoy ourselves. If that was the plan, the Creator has made a bad botch of it. What we are here for, essentially, is to advance some destiny, both within ourselves and within society. We are here because the relationships of life help us to develop our own humanity. It is our form of growth. Natural things, trees and plants, the creatures of the wilderness, are under the constant need for vigilance, are under constant pressure of circumstances. Nature must defend itself against the storms that sweep through the forests, defend itself against the tidal wave, the earthquake, must defend itself against all the natural hazards of life. Man has more or less created physical defenses against many of these conditions, not all, but many. But this does not mean that nature has no plan for him beyond the preservation of his own physical existence. As man solves the mystery of physical existence, he is faced with the greater mystery of psychological existence. He is faced with the need for the development of his own maturity. Now, we cannot say that the world moves in a completely consistent pattern toward growth. There are many interludes, many changes, many occasions which appear to be retrogressive. But out of the whole broad pattern, we know that man is moving inevitably toward self-control, self-direction, self-responsibility, self-discipline. These are the directions that nature wishes him to travel. These are the directions in which lie his hopes for security and peace. And nature, which is always using the same essential technique, having decided what was necessary, no longer permits man to have securities of any kind unless he developed these strengths of character within himself. Thus it happens that the individual today must either have the sense of responsibility or suffer. He must discipline himself or find the various things in life which he regards as desirable slipping away from him. So every once in a while people come in to find out how we feel that they should advance along the road of matrimony. Some are planning it, some are enduring it, some are recovering from it. But they're all here for some reason. Of course, those who are enduring it are by far the greater number, for the reason that those who are planning it are not usually philosophical at that time. The individual who has no basic subconscious maturity of judgment certainly is not in a good condition to plan a future when he is under heavy emotional stress. At this time, he is suffering from a number of defects for which we have no clear solution. One, he is suffering from youth, and youth is inexperience. In youth, the individual cannot know what he will know 20 or 30 years later. Therefore, in youth, there is only one strength for the individual, and this is the strength that has been taken from him today. This strength is parental example. This strength is the natural experience of growing up in a well-integrated home. If he has this experience, he will develop a subconscious power to direct his own affairs. But if he has lacked this integration in his own growth, he is then hopelessly at disadvantage when the time comes for him to select a marriage partner or attempt to establish a family. Actually, what kind of people work best together? There are two sayings that have come down in astrology that are open, I think, to some discussion. One is the natural attraction of opposites. We have a feeling today, and I have for a long time, that this attraction of opposites is one of the strongest forces in bringing people together. And from a study of charts, there is much to support this. Very many persons marry individuals who are born under the opposite sign from themselves, or whether it is in the month or the hour in which there are strong oppositions of factors in the charts. Why should opposition or dissimilarity be an attracting power? First of all, it is the attraction of the unknown. That which is different from ourselves is always intriguing, always suggesting some new experience or new advantage. Also, we are all seeking completeness in some way. Psychologically, we sense that a family must confer a certain measure of completeness. We marry someone in the hope of finding a greater and more perfect unity composed of two persons. To do this, it is obvious that whatever be our weaker points, it would be fortunate if the other person was stronger in those points. Whatever might be our areas where we have little insight, it is good if this other person has larger insight. And down through the centuries, when life went along on a reasonably even keel, it did prove extremely valuable for people to complement each other in their abilities and aptitudes. In those days, people had a larger sense of appreciation for certain values than we have now. For instance, the shopkeeper of 17th century England was always rather interested in keeping his religion in his wife's name. He wanted to contact religion through marriage. He didn't really say it this way, but he in his business was not especially devout, yet he sensed the need of devotion. He also wanted his children to be raised with good religious background. And as he was busy buying and selling and keeping shop, he sort of felt that his religious life was related to his home. Therefore, he really desired a stronger religious relationship with family. Today, this is a mixed blessing. Because today, the individual who is without religion usually does not want it. The individual who has a narrow interest wants to stay in it. The individual whose judgment is bad in certain matters does not want to be educated. He wants to continue to press his bad judgment to its inevitable disaster. Thus, there is less and less today of interest in this communion of values. We are insulted by persons who know anything we do not know. We are embarrassed if we happen to find a marriage partner who is a little more intellectual than we are. Instead of viewing these as complementary things, they become the basis of a powerful competitive process. So there is a great saying today that what the average person wants to marry is a pleasant, amiable, comfortable non-entity. He wants something that will not interfere with himself in any respect. And this is very largely true today of the woman also. She is more and more concerned with the things she wants to do. She is not inclined to bury herself in family. She is too well educated. She has had too much business experience, possibly prior to marriage. And she also regards her own feelings, her own attitudes, and her own career as extremely important, valuable things that are not to be compromised. Or if they are compromised, the loss of them may actually lead to a psychological neurotic condition. Today, a woman who is taken out of her natural liberties and forced into too powerful a domestic situation simply becomes ill. She is no longer able to adjust to it in many, many instances. Some do adjust, but again, where this adjustment occurs, it is largely the result of early childhood training, where the person has become aware of the essential values of family and home. So there is a question today as to whether contrasting personalities get along better. Nature seems to like to have it that way because it continually throws them together. It continually makes it a psychological or magnetic pull between persons who are magnetically polarized, who therefore represent the elements which, if combined in a pleasant chemistry, might result in a happy compound. Obviously, if two persons of similar temperament are both highly developed, both developed to the degree that self-discipline is guiding their courses of action, then they may make powerful contributions to each other because jealousies will not arise, antagonisms and contrasts will not be pointed up, and there will be the skill to handle the other person effectively from a psychological standpoint. But this takes time, it takes thought, it takes effort, and it takes affection. And we very seldom find people today who want to expend all of these things simply upon the comfort, happiness, or convenience of another person. The next point that perhaps arises is what might be termed the clash of basic elemental temperaments. In astrology, the signs of the zodiac are divided into four elemental groups composed of earth, fire, air, and water. And these elements may or may not be compatible. But it is true that as these elements react among themselves as elements, so they will have a tendency to react in the lives of persons born under these signs if they attempt to form relationships. When, for example, a water sign marries a fire sign, you have here a conflict. And much depends, of course, in the first place, upon which of the two is the more positive, better integrated member of the group, or at least which one is the more dynamic. It is true that a fire sign can put out too much energy, too much force. This fire sign can dry up water, and water can extinguish fire. A water sign can hurt the person born under the fire element. Hurt this person simply by extinguishing their enthusiasm, pulling down their natural ideals and principles. It is also true that the fiery personality is not compatible or happy for the water person, the water sign. It dries it up, changing the watered area into a desert. A desert in this case simply representing a sterility of enthusiasm or of manifested energies. So each of these groups of elements suggest the effect of people upon each other. They suggest how we have to watch and measure relationships in terms of these factors. In astrology, however, there is one factor that is very difficult to determine. And this factor probably can only be determined by an intimate knowledge of the person who is seeking the assistance. And that is the level upon which this person is going to react. All nature is divided into strata in one way or another. We are all upon levels. And these levels represent the degree of value in which various planetary situations will express themselves. Any individual can have any group of planets. Therefore, how he is going to react depends entirely upon the level of his own consciousness and his own integration. All things taken together, therefore, compatibility in marriage, it would seem from experience, depends more upon the levels of relationship than upon the actual positions of planets. If the levels are right, the planets will work out. If the levels are wrong, the planetary expressions cannot come into harmonious relationship. It is therefore rather important for the individual to marry, if possible, within a level in which the other person has had some common experiences with this level as a common denominator. If one person marries an individual who's socially too far removed in levels, there is bound to be additional complications. This is also true increasingly in problems of religion. Religious liberals may intermarry with comparative ease and with very little difficulty on a religious level, and their religious lives will be easily solved. But very intensely devout persons in very conservative faiths seldom do well to marry outside of them. Therefore, if we have a strong religious prejudice, then it is difficult for even the most continuous relationships to overcome this prejudice. The same is true of many other social activity areas. The individual who has certain likes and dislikes must be thoughtful in the selection of a marriage partner whose level of life is somewhat similar, though not identical. This is one of the problems that we always have to face. Another situation that arises in matrimony is the compatibility of age intervals. We know that people who are widely separated in ages have difficulties, but this is, again, not a clear picture. The reason why it is not a clear picture is because we measure age entirely in terms of the body. Therefore, we say that a man who is 60 who marries a woman who is 40 is probably marrying a woman too young for him. This may be true and it may not be true, because it is possible that the man is mentally and emotionally less mature or less old than his years, or the woman may be older in qualities of character and consciousness. I've known several instances in which marriages with extremely wide age intervals have been successful, and others where the intervals are very close, which were utterly unsuccessful. Again, all human physical problems depend largely for their working out upon the temperaments and attitudes and convictions of the persons involved. It certainly would be an advantage, I think, in the average family if some member of the family had some basic knowledge of astrology. It would not only be helpful in gauging the daily events of life, but would certainly be most useful when the time comes to consider the arrival of new persons as children in a family. It used to be that children were dominated from early life by the strong pressures of family discipline. A well-disciplined family gave support to children at a time when they were unable to give direction to their own emotions and thoughts. The child growing up in a secure, well-ordered family received, therefore, a tremendous endowment. He received an early training of obedience, of insight, and of some responsibility. The most successful families were where the children also had their duties to perform, were expected to contribute to the general happiness of the group, and the child was not supposed to start out at an early age on a willful course of complete self-satisfaction. So if the family was strong until the child was 10 or 12 years old, this child had a good deal of basic discipline. and this would be of the greatest value later. Today, however, lacking this discipline and lacking the incentives or the willpower to enforce discipline upon children, many parents are today in a state of complete bewilderment. They are also, many of them, absolutely under the tyranny of their own children. The child has gotten the upper hand, and nothing could be more tyrannical than a small human being with that discovery within his consciousness. So the parent needs some aid, some guide in determining the type of discipline or requirement that a child should have. And the use of the horoscope in determining the nature of the child, its own pressures, its own experiences, its own values, can be extremely helpful to a parent. The horoscopes of children are useful in several ways. First, they help to give us the key to the nature of the personality, which otherwise cannot be discovered until much later in life. Secondly, the chart gives us a certain degree of insight into aptitudes. It helps to direct the child into a proper educational area at a time when the child has no idea as to what it really wants to be or how it expects to get there. The chart further supplies valuable indication as to the health probabilities and the psychological integration of the child. If all these things are taken into consideration by thoughtful parents, they can make some kind of an intelligent project out of directing the child, instead of being in a state of total bafflement. This bafflement leads to despair, despair to indifference, and finally the child is left to its own resources. If the parent really felt that it had a key to the personality of the child, it probably would make a greater effort to understand and direct the child's life. So astrology in this area is particularly valuable. It is also valuable in the effort to determine the relationships of children themselves, between themselves, and to the various other members of an adult community existence. Many cases we know where the child needs a certain sensitive insight. If it does not receive this insight, its future is seriously damaged. There are other children, apparently, who do not sense this need for insight and get along very well without any help at all. But every so often, we come upon what we term normally the neurotic child. And this child does require guidance. And the moment the family finds that it has one of these willful, difficult, dominating children, where it discovers that the child does not adjust easily, does not work into family patterns, something should be done about it. The average family cannot face the bill resulting from elaborate use of child psychology, but much could be done simply from studying the birthday of that child to find out how it fits in to a vast world of people, many of whom have been born with very similar temperaments and personality problems. It can become a very interesting procedure to try to unfold a child without dominating that child, direct it without destroying its own natural capacities, and inspire it without catering to all of its whims. This is a challenge, and it calls for much more time and thought than the average adult wishes to expend on it at the present time. Now, it may also come about that in the course of time, two people with comparatively incompatible charts reach a parting of the way. So either together or separately, they come in to find out what they're going to do about a marriage that has ceased to be important, perhaps has become very difficult. It is interesting to know that in these particular times that we're living in, there is quite an epidemic of divorces among persons who have been married for a long time. In the last 4 or 5 years, we've had an unusual percentage of people who have been married over 20 years and are seeking separation. One would almost think they would have discovered the facts a little earlier along the way. Or perhaps, as is not so common but occasionally occurs today, there was the problem of trying to see that the children had reached a degree of self-reliance before the home was broken up. In any event, these people suddenly don't like each other anymore, or suddenly become articulate about dislikes that they have maintained over a period of years. Most of them complain that they have reached the breaking point, that they can no longer endure a situation. And yet 9 out of 10 of them are not very sure as to what the situation is. This problem of becoming totally fed up. I would suspect from the experiences that I have and some researches that I have made in statistics that the fed up situation is a more common cause of divorce today than infidelity. The individual is not really interested in anyone else. He's mostly interested in himself and the peculiar predicament in which he finds himself involved. Most of these divorces are based now upon one or both persons taking the attitude that they are simply not understood, that every effort they have made to achieve certain common goals or common ends, all these efforts have been rebuffed, that they live with a person who is either indifferent or actually malicious in attitudes or conditions, or a person whose faults, which always existed, have become too obvious to be endured any longer. Well, this type of situation seems to, in most instances, merely be a gradual process of one person waking up to the defects that were always present in the other. There are, of course, cases where the pressure of life has caused major changes in one personality. Major, but not basic. Major in the sense that they have caused the person to use his basic abilities or to emphasize his basic debilities in a particular way. One of the most common problems that we're developing today is the alcoholic marriage partner. This situation does not mean that somewhere along the line the individual became alcoholic. It means that all the way along the line, the individual was lacking in certain values, that this individual was lacking in the basic integrations of life. The average alcoholic is psychologically immature. Therefore, somewhere along the line, immaturity took a very childish route of escape and became alcoholic. What to do with this type of situation is always difficult. It's one of the hardest problems we have to work with. But if after a reasonable degree of effort, there is no improvement, usually it ends in some form of separation as the only honorable solution. And this brings us to another question that has always perturbed some people, and that is, can a divorce be an honorable situation? In our way of life, it certainly can. There were times, perhaps, when it was not really nearly as justifiable as it is today. But under the present pressure of existences, we find that individuals starting out together, say at 21, 22, 25, with approximately the same educational background and the same general family conditioning, begin life with about the same attributes and abilities, interests, desires, feelings, beliefs. But there is no way of determining at this time how these two persons are going to develop. If they developed together toward home, they would probably build a home. But if the instinct toward this union of purposes is not too strong, and in most cases it is not strong today, the marriage is not carefully considered, it is not built upon any clear vision of purpose, therefore it does not have a strong cohesive power. But without this strong integrating factor, which is not probably present, these two persons continue to develop as individuals. And as they go along through life, one develops more rapidly than the other. One develops more positive values. One perhaps develops a stronger ethical conviction. And 25 years after marriage, these two persons have, through the experiences of life, become strangers. They no longer have the same ideals and principles, as far as they can tell, that brought them together in the first place. These ideals and principles have been shadowed and overshadowed and involved in so many complexities that they are no longer recognizable. So that the two individuals are not the persons who married in the first place. And not being the persons who married in the first place, they must meet after an interval of 25 years, even if they're under the same roof, they must meet again as individuals and decide that they want to be married. If in the course of these years they have become so separate that this interest, this instinct, this value does not arise within them, only one of two or three possible answers can be achieved. One is that in place of the marriage relation, they develop a kindly, tolerant, patient type of friendship. These people may live together because it is easier, more convenient, because they really have nothing against each other, but not very much for each other. Also, under those conditions, one or other or both of these persons may drift away from a bond which no longer has any real value, and seek association with others who are attracted to them or to whom they are attracted by their present condition in society as persons. The values which have developed over the years may create new interests, new probabilities of relationship. The third problem, of course, is that these changes have gradually hurt. One individual or both may be desperately offended by the changes in the other person. They may find themselves neglected. They may find themselves the victims of everything from mental tyranny to physical cruelty. And under these situations, the problem of breaking up such a relationship is almost inevitable. It has to be faced. It has to be faced because in life, there is no such a situation as one which produces or results in nothing. Every situation must either add something or it will detract something. And in the modern way of life, individuals must always accomplish one of two things to save a shaky marriage. First, they must change themselves to the degree that they can hold that marriage together. Or else they must become sufficiently realistic to sit down together and solve the matter in an amicable and intelligent manner. All of the emotional pressures and hates which come from the over-delaying of separations should be carefully avoided, because they represent only suffering, ultimate suffering, to the person who has the wrong attitude, not to the other person. The next thing we have to realize is that one person cannot save a marriage in all or most cases. The complete sacrifice of one individual to the tyrannies of another will not solve the problem. As the marriage service states, marriage is an honorable state. And an honorable state cannot be preserved by dishonorable means. An honorable condition is one in which each individual has his rights, and these rights are guarded, protected, preserved. One individual cannot, by the total sacrifice of their own lives, bring happiness to another person. No one can make anyone else happy. We all have to keep happiness in our own names. And where it is obviously no longer possible for people to be happy, then the security of the individual psychologically and morally demands the solution of the problem. Now, some astrologers working with this problem like to set up charts for marriages. They feel that if they set up a marriage chart, and the chart is fortunate, that this is going to help to make a marriage successful. It does help to a degree. But I think that the general way of doing this is not as complete as it should be. I do not think that the main problem is simply to create a time or to select a time by astrology, by an astrological election, as it is called, which will result in an enduring marriage. I have labored with several individuals who had their marriages selected in this way. They complain of one problem, namely that the chart did keep them together, but never made them happy. They found they couldn't get apart. They were as though they were stuck on flypaper. One way or another, they could not figure a way to separate themselves. Psychologically, they were bound together by some strange pressure from fixed signs or something of that nature, but they weren't really happy. I know at least one or two haven't spoken to each other for years, but they're still married. The chart is holding. A magnificent example of the efficacy of astrological procedure. To my thinking, the chart should always be one of a time selected through a reconciliation of the charts of both involved persons. In other words, the time that is best for them both. The time in which the strong points of character have their best opportunity for expression, so that the individual can bring to this period of life all that is possible in compatibilities. In other words, the chart should act as a kind of receiving vessel into which both lives should be poured. And it should be a chart which favors both people as far as possible. Now, this isn't always easy, and anyone who works with it will discover another natural law, and that is that there's no such a thing as a perfect chart. There can be no such a thing as a life also completely protected from all adversities. But the selection of a time which favors the rights, the privileges, the insight, and the values of both persons seemingly is the one which works best for all concerned. Because actually, unless the marriage becomes a union of values, it is not important. To merely perpetuate a pattern is like trying to perpetuate a home in which the individuals within the home are no longer compatible. So I've always felt that the best way to select these times is through selecting a moment which is most favorable for those who are to be united, in which the present condition at the time of the marriage, the present condition of the heavens, is most favorable to the charts of both persons. This is sometimes a long and involved calculation, but it does often apparently help. We also have a tendency to believe that there are certain hours of the day, certain times which are more appropriate and more purposeful. And the tendency now is to try to select times which are near noon to bring the sun to the highest exaltation, perhaps with the moon increasing in light, and certainly at a time in which the ascending sign is compatible with both charts. Of course, you have to be a little careful in having people calculate their own for this particular event, for the reason that they have a tendency to pick the time best for themselves and not to be too thoughtful about what is going to happen to the other person. So all these things play into the same general patterns. But out of the whole theory of astrology in connection with marriage, I think we come back primarily to the psychological importance of being able to realize that people are wonderful chemistries of values, that they're not just simply masks in front of a vacuum, that behind each one of these masks is a living person. Our problem is to live with living people, just as they have to live with us. And the best marriage that I know of, one that endured past its diamond jubilee, was one in which each individual admitted frankly that the great formula for the successful marriage was that each person thought first of the good of the other. Keeping their minds off of self-pity and things of this nature, they were able to steer their course more effectively. If young people who are contemplating marriage can gather up sufficient resource and sufficient self-control to discuss their problem either with a marriage counselor or work with their horoscope, it would undoubtedly reduce a lot of bad marriages. It would give the individual greater insight and give people something to build on. The study of astrology extends far beyond these particulars and helps to integrate the individual around a philosophy of life built upon natural law, universal procedure, and divine purpose. And any individual who builds a home with a purpose, and that purpose is big enough to bind both persons to a common service, this has the best chance of succeeding. The individual who realizes that there are laws governing his own conduct that he cannot break with impunity, that he has responsibilities which he must learn to face, he has obligations which he must meet, and he has wonderful opportunities to share life if he is willing to share honestly and not merely attempt to tyrannize other people. If we could build a deeper philosophy of living under these relationships, they would certainly be more enduring and more valuable. As it is, these too many people come through an unfortunate marriage without really discovering anything important. They develop only antagonisms and antipathies. They do not realize the maturing power of experience on their own souls. They have not permitted themselves to mature under experience, rather they have permitted themselves to be injured by it. So in all these relationships, we are here to grow, we are here to be better people, and we are here to help other people. And there's no place like a home in which to grow, help, share, and serve. And if we meet the problem with this spirit over our actions, then these planetary forces operate in harmony with this purpose. If we remain, however, completely isolated, then these forces work out their patterns in separate ways. So by understanding the charts, by working with them, we can improve the probabilities of a happy and successful life. And we can also gain insight into the guidance and directing of the next generation. These things make the subject very valuable, and I'm not at all uncertain about the future of the general field. I believe within 50 years, astrology will be commonly used in many of these areas where either now there is nothing or a very involved psychological process which the average person cannot afford. So if the individual in the home wishes to take up a subject of this nature, it probably would do a great deal of good for all concerned. Well, our time is up, so we have to stop.